On this episode of Japan 2.0.
During our conversation today, it's been 45 minutes and the song has been playing in my head. Like, I just keep hearing, I'm holding it inside because I know I'll do a bad version if I try to hum it or something, but I just can't help but hear that song. This is David, and I'm one of your hosts of your favorite podcasts about Japan and Japan life and Japan food and Japan convenience stores. What else, Matt?
Wow, that's Japan everything. Yeah, no, this is your one-stop Japan shop, you know, Japan right. 2.0 podcast.
Today, I'm Matt. Yes, and Matt has a very special guest on his end. Who
yeah.
might that be?
Hi, I'm Emily, and I'm Matt's wife. Thanks for having me for this very special podcast episode.
What's your favorite episode?
This is your second or,
yeah, I was going to say, what's
your favorite
episode?
Second or third time on, right?
That I've been on?
No. What's your favorite episode of the podcast?
I like the episode about convenience stores and animals.
That was a recent one. I thought you would name one of the ones that you've been on.
Yeah, I like that podcast about,
was it Tokyo?
Kyoto?
I think you were on Tokyo and Kyoto.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
and
right.
Tokyo.
And the Katamari.
That's
Katamari. You did make a brief appearance on the Katamari episode too.
The fans have been clamoring to have me back. So.
That's right. Well, it's always good to have a female perspective, I think, on the show. And it's a great thing that you bring among many others. This is a new thing we wanted to do at Japan 2.0 for a while, which is like kind of media reviews. I'm surprised we've not done one so far, but we've talked about doing like album reviews before, movie reviews, and we're saving them up for a time in need. And I think during this time where the world is on quarantine and people are stuck at home, kind of reviewing some of our favorite media or media that says something about Japan will be very nice for our audience, I hope, because then they can go spend time with that and consume that and hopefully be occupied and enjoy it with us.
Yeah. I know that we've talked about this for a long time, and we have a list of movies and video games and albums we want to talk about. Yeah, so
we have a little offshoot show.
Another podcast feed, right? The podcast network, the Japan 2.0 podcast network.
We're thinking of doing, we typically do two podcasts in a month. So we're thinking of doing maybe one a month of these while the world's kind of self-quarantining until that stops and Matt and I can record together again in the same room, that is. We thought we'd do one of these a month, and then we'll do one kind of our normal topics a month.
Goes. Yeah. Hopefully we don't have to do this forever, and David and I can be in a you know, recording together, you know, in a room together somewhere, Tatami Studio or...
That's right.
Or David Studio.
Roomba Studio.
Roomba Studio, that's right. I almost forgot.
Roomba's my vacuum's name, by the way, my automatic robot vacuum cleaner. Anyway, to get into the topic, though, our first media that we're going to review is a movie. And it's a awesome cult classic. I can't believe I didn't know of it sooner, called Houseu, or House. And it's got quite the one to start with, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. Directed, written, I believe, by Nobuhiko Obayashi. That's
got
his
it.
Name.
Obayashi.
And
R.I.P.
I think it was, yeah, he just recently died. So
he died last week.
Rest in power, you know?
Rest in power, I like that one.
Rest in production, because, I mean, he's definitely the production heavy, you know?
In heaven.
Yeah, he did not. I was worried he died of coronavirus. I mean, there's no good way to go, but yeah, he just died of, I think, a lung issue related to smoking, perhaps.
Yeah, lung cancer or something.
Yeah.
He had finished a movie. I think I sent you a link to that too. It's called like The Labyrinth of Cinema. And I think that was his last movie that came out. And I believe that came out 2018 or 2019. So, I mean, he was a very prolific film director. And
he did more than just films.
He did more than just films, yes. And I know we'll get into that a little bit more, but Haosu is definitely a standout from his catalog. And
peaked a bit early.
Yeah, it might be like his biggest and best work. But I've heard the new movie is actually pretty good, so I am interested in checking it out. And hopefully it is.
I saw
a trailer. I thought it looked pretty interesting. It looked cheesy.
Well,
but
house can't imagine.
yeah, but in line with what I've seen of his previous works.
Mm.
So House was in the late 70s, 1977. So it's I don't know how old you are, but for some people that might consider that an older movie. It's definitely a product of its time, I think. And I think you have to look at it with that kind of perspective or that kind of lens to consider what was being done in the 70s, especially technically. For me, I think I look at this movie in two halves. One is the story or the narrative, and then the second half is the technical skills or the editing or the production level. And the takeaway or the value is very different, and there's a strong kind of dichotomy, I think, of those two things, and that's what makes the movie so unique. But anyway,
before we get into it, though, I have to put this disclaimer out there. If you haven't seen Haosu, you need to watch it. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, I've never heard of this movie before, I highly recommend you turn off the podcast. Just pause it. Don't turn it off. Pause it. And then watch House.
Keep it playing.
Come back.
Yeah, I think you have to be in the right mood for it, though. Like,
I think so.
You should go in with a lighthearted mood, and you should go in wanting to laugh. Let's just say that before we get into it. So if you're just going to turn this off now and you're not in the mood to laugh, then don't watch it.
You should go in for the chills, too, because it is scary.
Uh-huh.
It is creepy. I wouldn't say it's scary. Well, for some people it might be, I guess. Yeah. I would
suspense.
Say it's creepy.
Suspense.
Yeah, and it is suspenseful.
You're not going to be, you know, terrified, like you can't sleep at night, but there's moments, some like jump scares type of thing.
Cheesy,
you know?
Gore. Cheesy gore.
Yeah, really cheesy. Yeah.
There are a couple of scenes where I go, ooh, that's that was gross.
Yeah.
<You know? laughs>
But it's, again, like you said, 1977, like special effects. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, I would say comedy first, horror second.
Oh,
that, for
100%.
Sure. Yeah.
So anyway, let's get in. We're going to do a synopsis. If that wasn't enough to sell you on it and you still want to stick around, you can listen and hear what we have to say about it a little bit more. And at any point, feel free to turn this off and go listen to it and then come back and listen to this after. I think you'll get more from the podcast if you've seen the movie. But maybe we have to sell you on it first, right?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So House is a movie about a young girl named Oshare, which means gorgeous, and her six friends, her six schoolmates, right?
Yes. Do you know them all?
I can name the seven dwarfs, but I cannot name all seven of the house.
Oh,
I can name
them
all.
All
right, gorgeous.
Let's call a challenge.
Okay, we got gorgeous, sweet, fantasy, professor, Mac, kung fu, and gorgeous. Did I say gorgeous?
You said gorgeous, yeah.
I said gorgeous. Oh, no. No, I forgot one.
There's
who did I forget?
There's the one that we always forget.
No, I said sweet.
Oh.
Anyway, as Matt and Emily are thinking about these, they're all, it's such funny names, because the names are the character archetypes that they are. And Mac means stump, is short, is a nickname for stomach in Japanese, or I think in the West it's a nice translation to, you know, McDonald's or something. But yeah, but they're all archetypes to the character, you know. So the professor, you know, is that her name? The professor?
Yeah, professor. Yeah.
So she's like a smart, nerdy one. Kung Fu is the girl who knows Kung Fu and can, you know, stand up for the group. Mac is just kind of the chubby laugh, easy laugh, you know. Yeah, so the names are pretty amazing.
Oh, Melody. How could I forget? Melody is the last
ding, ding,
one.
Ding, ding, ding. Her death is really good.
The best.
Yeah, so there's these seven schoolgirls, and they're going on a school trip, right?
Yeah. And, well, they have plans to go on a school trip with one of the greatest characters, Mr. Togo. Mm-hmm.
Who's a very handsome, dreamy teacher.
Ladies, get ready.
Fantasizes about Togo. And
those sideburns.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Those sideburns are nice. Mm. They're planning on going on this field trip with Mr. Togo, but Mr. Togo's sister is having a child, so he can't go on the trip. So the trip's essentially canceled.
He disappears very quickly. I think the first time you see the movie, if you're not careful, he's just like gone, and you don't realize why he's gone.
Yeah,
he says it real quickly, but it's all fast,
and then he's just gone. And he was like in the beginning of the movie, it feels like they're playing to make him a really important character or something, and it feels like the actor like had a prior obligation, and they just wrote it in real fast, and he was gone or something. I don't know.
Well, I have a lot to say about Mr. Togo, so we get a little further.
We'll
into
save that. All right.
Yeah, we'll save it. But yeah, so what they end up deciding to do is go to Gorgeous's aunt's house.
Yes, and she's a central character of the story, the aunt.
Yeah, that's the change of plans. Mm. And before that, we meet Gorgeous's father and new stepmother. And Gorgeous is not too thrilled to meet her new stepmother.
No, she is not at all.
And the stepmother comes up with a plan that... in order to win Gorgeous over, she'll surprise her at the aunt's house.
Yeah, she'll give her a good visit there, and they'll have a bonding moment, and then she'll like her and embrace her.
Yeah,
and, sounds a great setup for an awesome.
Yeah, movie. It doesn't sound like that part would make a whole heck of a lot of sense, but when you're watching the actual movie, it kind of does. You have to see the stepmother
through the mosaic glass, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to see the stepmother to fully understand. So they end up going on the Shinkansen or the train or whatever, you know, and they're going out to the countryside where Gorgeous's aunt lives, and they run into a few colorful characters on the way over to the house.
Oh, they do, yeah.
Do you want to say something?
No, there's lots of things we could say, but just kind of zooming along, right? They get to the house, and things in the beginning seem all right in the very, very beginning, but it's not too fast until things get a little weird, right?
Right. One thing that we've seen is this cat is following around Gorgeous.
Oh, yes, yes.
And the cat is always in the scene. Like, I was always, like, running around. It's a white cat. And what kind of cat is that? Is that like a,
I don't know.
It's a Scottish Fold. Scottish Fold.
No, it's not a, always not a Scottish Fold.
That's an old throwback.
Yeah, it is. The cat, long-time listeners will get that.
The cat seems to know the ant. Like, it's very friendly with the ant. It's jumping
little,
in the ant's
lap. A little
lap.
Too friendly, you might say.
A little too friendly. Yeah. Yeah.
The cat is friendly with Gorgeous and friendly with the ant. Right. And seems to ignore everybody else, so for the most part. So
he got questions about the cat.
Yeah, so the cat keeps showing up, and then at the house, some mysterious things start happening, and the girls start getting into predicaments where they, you know, are disappearing.
That's right. So the first to disappear is Mac. Right?
Yeah,
Mac.
Which kind of surprises me.
Mac is one of my favorite characters.
No?
So,
why?
You know, it makes me a little bit sad. You think so? I would think that, well,
I guess.
I mean, the most simplistic is Sweet.
Yeah.
I think someone's going to have
a problem. I could barely remember.
Like, this movie translating to 2020 and just the political climate of today. I feel like if anyone's going to have a problem with the movie, they're going to have a problem with Mac. That she's just like archetypical overweight person who's always hungry and eating.
Which
she's
not always overweight at all.
Yeah, but I feel like most
standards, yeah.
That's true.
Most characters in this are kind of painted in that light. They are that stereotype of their name, right? Like, I mean, yeah, basically, that's all they are.
They all are. But she's the one I feel that if you're very, very, very sensitive, you might be slightly offended by the character Mac.
Yeah, I could see that.
I was just surprised that she disappeared first, because she's kind of like a bit of the comedic relief, you know, and this movie is kind of like a comedy in some way. So I felt like when she disappeared first, it was like, wow, like they didn't take one of the characters, like the professor or somebody who's, you know, or like you said, not Melody. What's the other one?
Sweet.
Like,
Sweet is the most.
She's so forgettable.
Like, forgettable one. In fact, when her death scene came, like I was.
Who's that?
Gosh, I think she's the second one that dies.
Yeah.
And when her death scene came, I was like, who is she again? Is she like the maid at the house? Like, I couldn't even remember her from the beginning.
The first time you watch the movie, half of the girls, when they die, it's like, which one was that again? Because you're just wrapping your head around it all. And there's just so much going on.
Yeah.
But the way I viewed Mac, our last thing on Mac was, you know, like the stereotype in Western horror movies that the minority or the black person is the first one to go?
Yeah.
In Japan, it's monocultural, right? So there's, you know, everyone's Japanese. So I viewed her as like the one who's the most different. She's kind of the minority. So of course it meets that kind of stereotype, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. That's an interesting,
analogy.
Connection to make.
Yeah, that is.
I don't think there's anything to that. I think it's kind of just coincidence, but.
You might be right.
Yeah. Her death is one of the more gruesome ones.
Definitely.
It cranks it up a notch straight away. Like when you get that scene.
Well, when her revival, I think, is the most amazing part. So one thing that happens in this movie is when the house takes like one of the girls, they usually come back in some sort of like, you know, yokai kind of way. And
we should be clear. The house is a character in itself. So the aunt's house is where they're all at, and they're hanging out and having a good time at first. And then, the house starts to come alive, essentially. And
we do get some backstory too. The backstory is kind of important, where the aunt had a fiance who went off to war and he was killed in the war, and she was really jealous because Gorgeous's mother found love and got married and was living a good life, and she never had that. So it's kind of like a grudge, like a traditional Japanese grudge movie in that way.
But not The Grudge, the other horror movie.
No, but I think though those movies, The Grudge, The Ring, you know, they kind of take some influence from those kind of yokai stories.
We do see the scene when I think Gorgeous is in the bath and the hair kind of like comes up on her shoulder, which feels very Grudge.
There are nods to definitely that kind of tradition, horror tradition in Japanese. So I don't know if it started here or, you know... I'm sure some people took influence from this movie. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a hit in Japan. It did well in theaters. It wasn't like a blockbuster or anything like that, but it made money. It was really big at the teen audience. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the house is a character. The house is kind of coming alive to some very subtle ways in the beginning. So much so that, you know, as these characters die, the other girls don't think much of it. They don't really believe it, right? So Max, where'd she go? She's lost, I guess. She'll come back later.
The only one that believes it, of course, is Fantasy, because she can come up with these things in her imagination, right? So, but nobody believes her because she's Fantasy, right?
She's kind of ditzy, right? And seemingly. So the other girls.
And then.
Well, they just think she's kind of maybe seeing things, you know, she's always daydreaming and probably, coming up with these things. So when she comes in, she's the first one to encounter Mac in the well.
Yes.
Head in the well when she's going to get the watermelon, right? So then she comes back in and she's freaking out that Mac disappeared and she saw her head, you know. Biting came in back and bit her in the the butt.
Yeah, it's classic dramatic irony, right? Where the audience knows something, that one character knows something, but no one else does, and you have that kind of tension in, like, you guys are idiots.
So
she dies. So every girl has a death scene in this movie, and the death scenes are definitely, like, it's one of the coolest parts of the movie, right? It's like how they die.
Oh, definitely. I think they all die in imaginative and special effects heavy ways, you know.
Can we talk about though the Sweet's death?
Sweet's death with the pillows? Oh, so Emily has a theory about this.
Well, right,
let's hear it.
So
I don't know if I so much have a theory as just like how did she I was just so confused by that death because she just gets like basically attacked by futons
and pillows,
you know,
and
pillows, and then she's dead. But I'm assuming that she traded places with the doll in that scene because we see that doll once they uncover the futons.
We also were talking about how Sweet's not in the movie all that much and doesn't have very many lines, and we were kind of wondering if she was if she was really popular on the set or something, because she her death is so forgettable and
she's so
fast, cool. You know, and she's so forgettable in the movie.
They tried to write her out.
It seems like they tried to write her out, and I think there might be something there to that. It did seem kind of suspicious.
Huh, I wonder. I've seen the movie 2-3 times, I think. And 3 or 4 months ago was the last time. And you're mentioning the futon scene. I barely even have a memory of it.
That's the kind of scene it
it's
is.
It's the weakest death of all of them, I would say. It would just seem like...
To be honest, I only really remember Mac, Melody, and Kung Fu's deaths. You guys will remind me, I'm sure, as you go through fresh in your mind. But those are the ones that I could like recite right now off the top of my head.
Yeah. Well, we don't even see... Fantasy die, actually, right?
No, Fantasy's the only one that kind of...
We don't see her die.
She just accepts being in the house.
All right, well, let's go through the order more. So Sweet's the second one to die by
Sweet's the second one to die.
By futon, yeah.
Okay. And then...
By pillow.
I believe Melody is next. Melody is... She's attracted to the piano, and she goes to the piano and starts playing it, and then loses her fingers.
Yeah, Melody's not my favorite character. We'll probably get into... I think we all probably have the same favorite of the girls, at least. But I think Melody's death is the coolest one.
It's the best,
because it... Sure. That uses what, you know, we'll probably get into a little bit more in the second half, but the editing techniques I think are really just cutting edge at the time, and really kind of give me the trademark feel of the movie. Her death, it really uses those special kind of psychedelic techniques to the best. All, you know, the audio, the editing, the video, kind of a crazy collage, quick cuts, and that's awesome,
I would say this is the most scary, like, intense kind of part, too, because at the same time as Melody is playing the piano and getting killed, Gorgeous is up in the upstairs putting on her, like, aunt's makeup and her bridal gown and stuff.
It's kind of more of a psychological, creepy, the whole, what she's doing up there in the makeup room, right?
Like, possession, almost.
Yeah, it's like the house is possessing Gorgeous.
Or aunt is, I think.
Or the aunt, I don't know.
Maybe now's the time to get into that. The aunt and the house seem to be kind of one and the same, right? Like, somehow connected.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole kind of thing you find out towards the end of the movie. So, yeah.
So after Melody dies, I think Fantasy and Kung Fu realize something weird's going on.
Yeah,
and they
at this point, it's like, all right, what's going on here? The jig is up.
Yeah, so they go to find, I believe they go, Kung Fu, Fantasy, and Professor go to find Gorgeous. And that's when Kung Fu gets her big scene. Because I believe Kung Fu takes on all the ghosts, like, into this amazing Kung Fu scene.
The chandelier scene?
Oh, the chandelier,
Oh, great.
Chandelier, and then she gets kicked outside, and she's fighting the ghosts, you know, out in the very old-school kung fu style, wirework, you know, kind of scene. And unfortunately, it ends up in Kung Fu's death. I mean, I don't want to play my hand, but I might give you a clue to my favorite.
Now's our time, I think, to talk about Kung Fu. There's a lizard in that scene, too, is there not? A crazy, like a lizard dies or something?
No, that's the fish, at the beginning.
The fish. Are you thinking of the fish?
The beginning when the chandelier falls, when they first walk in, it kills the lizard.
The lizard, yeah.
It's,
and the cat's eating the lizard.
Okay.
No, at this point, it's just Kung Fu doing, fighting the ghosts in the house.
You guys like Kung Fu the best, too, right?
I mean, Kung Fu's hands down.
I do. I love Kung Fu, but I also really like Mac as well. you know, she's got that minority representation.
I think where Mac is like the archetypical, like, matriarchy, like, yeah, like just like some girl side character. Like, Kung Fu is like a strong female protagonist. And I think that's what makes her cool, especially at the time.
I think Kung Fu's the most protagonist out of everybody, you know, where they all kind of fit their, like, their stereotype. Kung Fu actually has, like, a little bit of agency. And in some ways, you know, she's bullish and she doesn't believe anything that's happening in the house. But she doesn't seem like the victim, you know.
She's
being active.
Until she gets killed.
Right? Like, gorgeous, like, the main character, gorgeous. She's just, like, up in the room doing her makeup. And, like, she kind of just disappears and it's off doing her own little finding herself thing. Yeah, where Kung Fu feels like she's the one who's, like, taking things in her own hands, right?
Yeah. Which is the one that, like, kept waiting for Mr. Togo to come.
That's fantasy.
Yeah. Like,
fantasy
is
waiting for
Mr.
Togo.
They kept, like, saying, like, oh, once Mr. Togo's here, like, everything will be okay. Kung Fu's taking care of it. I think she you know.
Yeah, taking care of business, yeah.
That's right. She's got it.
Yeah, and we all love Kung Fu movies, too, so I think that doesn't hurt the case there.
That's true.
Yeah, and I mean, the Kung Fu wire work and stuff, that's all pretty great. I mean, it's pretty cheesy and not the best wire work in Kung Fu action, but that's part of the charm.
That's right.
So then I believe Professor and Fantasy go to rescue Gorgeous in a scene that's also probably one of the second most psychological scary kind of scenes, where the cat attacks them with the glowing eyes and blood starts pouring into the tatami room.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and it makes you kind of wonder what's going on under your tatamis, you know.
That's right. Is that the picture, the painting of the cat there, or not yet?
Yes.
The painting of the cat, and the blood's coming out of the cat's mouth, and the ant and the cat are both kind of like trying to drown them. Professor falls into the blood and ends up drowning in a probably one of the most I would say pervy scenes of the movie.
Some of the camera angles are
yes, definitely. I'm sure in the second half we'll talk a little bit about that. And then Fantasy is taken by Gorgeous, who just keeps her at the house, I guess. You know, it's a little unclear what happens, but it seems like Fantasy accepts her fate as a part of the house.
At the end there, when she sees Gorgeous, who's obviously at that time possessed, Fantasy's floating on one of the tatami mats in the blood. And she reaches out to Gorgeous and says, like, I believe now or something. And then, you know, Gorgeous takes her and gives her this warm hug. And then Fantasy says something like, thank you, mommy, or something.
Yeah,
and
thank I was you, like, mom,
and so
I, believe.
I don't, yeah. I'm still trying to figure out why she called her mom in that instance. I was hoping somebody would have an answer for this, but why did she call her mom in that moment? But
yeah,
we may never know.
it requires a rewatch. That's what it requires.
All right, one more time. But yeah,
I think after that, then the last thing is the stepmom arrives at the house, and
yes, she does.
And then she has like an amazing scene.
Is it just
a song is playing?
Okay, and it's very epic.
Wind.
There's wind in the hair.
Yeah, yes. It's one of the Giorgio sung songs. Like, you know, the band that did the music for them? The guys that did Monkey Magic?
You have the album, right? The vinyl?
I have the Monkey Magic album. album, but yeah.
It's not Giorgio. It's
Gorgio or something like that.
Gorgio, okay. Yeah,
I'll look it up. But
Albert, our friend of the show, another frequent contributor, he said they were like kind of a big deal in the 70s side group. Like, not cool or like anything, but kind of like the Monkees or something of Japan.
They seem like the Monkees, yeah. I mean, they have a song called Monkey Magic, so
Maybe, yeah. It's just in my subconscious. Yeah, that's right. It's a song, and they have a moment together, the two, Gorgeous and her stepmom.
Yeah, and it's implied that, like, the house is gonna feast again, so.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the end of the movie, and that's a synopsis, but this movie has so much more to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I think us describing the synopsis, we talked a lot about the death scenes and stuff. We described the movie in the beginning as a comedy, but you wouldn't really get that from what we just said. So stick around maybe in the second half, and we'll kind of go into some of the deeper themes, the making of the movie, and just going deeper with the house.
Sounds good.
And we're back.
Yes, we are. We're talking about your favorite horror fantasy movie.
Comedy.
Don't forget comedy. It needs to be in there. Yeah.
I watched the
Dromedary.
All the behind the scenes features and stuff to get ready for this podcast. And the director describes it. He says, I don't think of it as a horror movie. I think of it as a fantasy movie.
Oh.
And,
I was kind of thinking fantasy mm-hmm. horror. Yeah.
I'd say, fantasy suspense. But one of the reasons he says that is, like, his daughter, who was maybe middle school to high schooler at the time, junior high is what they say here, helped them a lot with the movie, the concepts of the movie. And they sat down together, mm-hmm. and she gave him a lot of the ideas for it. So to give you, like, a little history and stuff behind it, he was a commercial director, as we talked about, and his commercials were kind of known for being really stylish and having a lot of crazy effects and stuff. So that was really his thing with commercials. And they sat down and they said, hey, Toho Cinema. Toho is a big conglomerate here. They own everything from grocery stores and movie theaters and a production company. And they said, we want you, Jaws had just come out in the States and it was a big hit. And they said, we want you to make a movie, the Japanese version of Jaws. And he started
thinking. It's more like Poltergeist, don't you think?
So here's how that happened. So, like, he sat down and, like, made a movie about a bear, and he was describing it to his daughter, and his daughter's like, oh, what? You gotta go to America, Dad. Like, Japanese movies are lame. Like, there's no such thing as, like, good Japanese movies like Jaws. And then he's, like, describing his movie to her, and she's like, no, this is the worst. Like,
it's not good.
She's like, this is a Japanese movie. This is the problem. She's like, what you should do is, like, make a movie about, like, a house and, like, lots of, like, really cool, like, cute girls. And, like, just hanging out in the house. And somehow that was the idea that spawned it all, and it turned into the movie that it is. I don't quite get how. But I do think it's amazing that he really gives a lot of credit to his daughter to, like, starting off the movie. And it feels like it's told from the perspective of a kid. Like, just how frantic the movie is, all over the place. It's very unstable. You know, a kid, one minute they want a cookie, the next minute they see Pokemon and they're running over there. And maybe I'm speaking about my 5-year-old kid, but, like, so disjointed that I can really see how, I don't know if he meant this or anything, or it's one of those things where they do it and then afterward they're trying to kind of save themselves a bit to make it sound deeper than it is. But, you know, he says that it's supposed to be, like, told from the perspective of a kid or a young teenage girl.
I could see that. I could see a kid coming up with the names of each of the girls and then saying that they're going out on this trip to the summer trip and stuff. I mean, it makes a lot of sense because it is kind of a juvenile story in a lot of ways.
It's supposed to be, I guess, Gorgeous's story. So, like, yes, I guess it's made for her perspective a bit.
Yeah,
but I don't know if that was intentional or not, to be honest.
The commercial part is always something that really fascinates me because a lot of the movie feels like a commercial. Mm-hmm. There are scenes where, especially with, I think it's with the stepmom, where she's walking out, getting out of a car, walking over to the house for like 5 minutes, and she's just smiling and the music's playing and her scarf is blowing in the wind. Yeah. And it doesn't look like a movie. It looks like a television commercial or the movie looks like a travel like something you'd see at a travel office, you know, playing in the background.
It really feels like they're trying to sell that mom, that stepmom, like, I don't know what the deal is with her, but someone really liked her.
I mean, I imagine that her scenes were there for comedic sake, because when she first walks out, I mean, it's so over the top, you know, it's that, like, typical hair's blowing, and she's got this, like, really light scarf that's just blowing, and I mean the lighting, everything, it just makes her it's very like angelic, you know.
Yeah.
And that scene itself feels very much like you're watching like a play, almost like it just feels like you're on a set of watching it in a theater or something. It doesn't feel like a movie necessarily. I don't know, it just feels like you're watching it on a set, you know.
Yeah There's times where I think this movie does look like a set production, like it a does. Very amateur set production, where
you can see
you see the seams, you know.
Seams, yeah.
There's one scene in particular where they're driving and there's this humongous set painting in the back.
Yes.
And then it cuts away. Amazing. And then there's this tiny like miniature version of the set painting, and I was just like, what happened there? That was such a
wonder if
a
it's intentional
crazy transition
or not, because then there's other parts of the movie, like I was kind of hinting at before getting to editing, where it's like it's so good and it's so I've never seen like kind of camera tricks like that, and it's all before computers and stuff, right? Where they do things very convincingly and very stylish when they're on the train, you know, going out. They look out the window and it's so cool. So it feels like you kind of want to give him credit and think maybe he meant to do that, but it was his very first feature film too. So I don't know.
Yeah, there's choices. It had some of these choices had to be intentional because like Mr. Togo is a good example of this, where his section is less like a commercial, more like a Benny Hill style television show, like a sitcom kind of, complete with stop motion animation, and you know, like him falling, harming his butt and stuff, you know,
getting stuck in a bucket.
The non-Japanese actor in there is great.
Yeah, couple on the train. So. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. The painter. Yeah, bye, Mr. Painter, or whatever the line is. Yeah. But
weird.
But yeah, the movie tends to do that. Depending on which character it's with, it kind of switches to a different style.
Mm-hmm. I guess so, to tell their perspective or something, right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know why he made these choices.
It has that effect,
I think going into the editing, I think that's what we should go next. And I think that this movie really does many difficult editing techniques that look cheesy or, you know, like you would ask, why would you do this technique? But obviously, he knew how to do them, you know, like, I mean, these are not easy things to do, especially in 1977. And you would ask, why are you doing this? But he does it to comedic effect, or
just because, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, I think just because he had it. Yeah, had it available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like he was kind of experimenting too, like just pushing film and editing to the limits, you know? I'm trying to think of other 70s movies that were doing stuff like this, and I can't really think of anything, you know?
Hmm.
No, I mean, there's nothing. It's
the
like
color,
white.
The color palette is so cool, too. It's very
Yeah.
saturated colors.
There's scenes where I think one of the girls holding something, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but just a drip of blood, like comes of like pixelated blood comes out of from under her fingertips.
Uh-huh.
And I was just thinking, like, what a weird that must have taken so long to figure out that shot, and it must have taken so long just to make that little drop of blood that you only see for like a second. And this movie is full of scenes like that, you know, where it's just like these tiny special effects all over everything, and. For 1977 standards, these were, I mean, it's probably the cutting edge for television or something, but you wouldn't see it in a movie. With this many.
I think if the movie was just the story that we described in the first half, and I think if you just listen to that first half and you've not seen the movie, you didn't watch the trailer or anything like that, you'd probably, like, turn it off, you know, just be like, well, okay. Mm-hmm. Like, the story is not good or interesting, or it's kind of hard to follow, right? But it's the visuals and the audio, I think, that and the editing, they really kind of make it special. We didn't talk about the music at all yet, but yeah, it has this kind of haunting theme that repeats over and over. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the worst loop. Like, they just cut it at the weirdest part. Where you can tell it's
there's different versions of it.
There
you
are,
know?
Yeah. There's different instances.
And there's lyrics. I was surprised to find out that Gorgeous sings at like almost the end of the movie.
Okay, yeah,
right? She sings the
lyrics to it. I was like, oh, I didn't realize it had lyrics, but
all that stuff's kind of like cutting edge and cool. It makes you think, well, maybe there's something more to this. Like this guy clearly knew what he was doing, and it's very advanced in that way. So what? Like, it makes you, for me at least. It makes me think I'm missing something, or that something about the movie just requires multiple viewings. It's one of those funny kind of cult classics, you know, like Rocky Horror or The Room or something, where the more you watch it, you know, the funnier it is too. But
yeah,
I think I'm always trying to just figure out the story a bit more. And like I said, I think I've watched it 3 times, and every time I do kind of unlock something that I didn't quite get the first time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this time I noticed the fantasy arc. Like, I think fantasy's arc is kind of interesting in this movie. Not fantasy, the genre of fantasy, the girl in the movie. Yeah, yeah. And then I thought her and Professor were kind of interesting, because fantasy is the one that would believe everything, and Professor's the one that's like, this can't be happening, this can't be happening, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there are some, I don't know, meta commentaries on, like, how... I don't know, like, how people would act. There's something going... You're right. There is something going on in the movie, but it is hard to piece together just because it's so distracting at times.
Yeah. Even still, like, I don't have all the answers. The director... I didn't get to watch... I watched about 70% of the special features before this, and he was saying that he's born in Hiroshima, and this movie and all his work in general, like, says something about the, you know, the bombing and humanity and stuff. And he didn't quite spell that out to, like, what he meant by that. But I think there's probably something there that now that I know that when I go in, I'll kind of watch it with that lens next time.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah.
There's this other director who spoke on the special features. His name is Ty West. He's like a horror director. I've never heard of him, but he was trying to say like all his favorite movies are movies that just defy genre conventions. And, like, again, you could call this a fantasy movie, you can call it a horror movie, you can call it a comedy. You call it any of those things, you'll say, I've never seen a horror movie like this. I've never seen a comedy like this. I've never seen a fantasy like this, right? And he said, like, for him, that's what he strives. Like, when he sees a movie at this point in his life, you know, watching thousands of movies or whatever, that's what he strives to do, is, like, I've never seen something like this, some kind of feature in a movie. And that gets harder and harder to do the more of a film fan you are, the more movies you kind of consume. And he said House, just for him, is one of his favorite movies, because he can't think of so many different ways you can look at this movie and say, I've never seen a movie that edits like this. I've never seen a, you know, movie that stars traditional actors in such a way as this, or which I think is something we should talk about a bit, right? The girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did think of what I was going to say, and I was going to say was that every scene is so interesting. Like, every scene that you look at, there's something going on. There's something going on in the background. There's
visually,
in the backgrounds, there's like some foreshadowing for things that are going to happen in the future. Mm. And I think that, yeah, it's just, it's an amazing visual feat.
Really is.
It's good to good to watch multiple times too, because I feel like the first time I watched it, yeah, like you said, that you're trying to figure out what's going on, you miss a lot, and then the second time watching it back, I was able to see a lot more, like you said, the foreshadowing moments where I'm like, oh, I saw that, you know, plant move, you know, which kind of shows that maybe there's some haunted objects in the house and stuff that I didn't catch the first time. So yeah, definitely recommend watching it multiple times. Not just once.
Every scene, every cut has something hidden in it. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Definitely.
So visually amazing. Yeah. Mm.
So the girls, the female actresses are all people he had worked with. Not all, but mostly like commercial actresses, you know, who just done 30-second spots here or there. So the acting in the movie is pretty bad. And I think that's where a lot of the comedy comes from. It's just the bad delivery of their lines or just... awkward interaction.
It's bad, but you know, it's also amateurish in a very it's very endearing, you know. It doesn't come off as like super, it's cheesy, but it's not super bad acting. It's not totally stilted acting.
Yeah. Hmm. The only one that I think is like a bad actress would be Fantasy's
not great. Yeah.
She's probably the worst out of all of them, but the rest of them, you know, you're watching it. Yeah, it just feels like an amateur movie they're not the best.
I think
Academy Award winning.
People will give some grace to when movies are not in their native language, right? So like it's in Japanese, so it's hard to know how bad the dialogue is. Is it just lost in translation a bit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but for me, a lot of the comedy comes from the acting and the lines and the delivery. Not to mention there's nonsensical things happening on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that even though I think they really put themselves into those roles, though. I mean...
They did.
It seems like a play, maybe a bad play, but it seems like a play where the love's there, you know? Mm. It's like play acting is what I'd... Mm-hmm. compare it to, you know, no disrespect to people that do plays out there, but I don't know. I mean, it's just the feel I get from the performances.
Do you want to get into some of our final thoughts and words?
Yeah. I think we can't talk about House without talking a little bit about the music and the sound effects and stuff. There are a lot of weird choices with the sound effects as well. There's a scene where they drop a watermelon into a well and their speech becomes like this garbled, like digitized mess that is to replicate water. But it definitely doesn't sound like they're speaking underwater. I mean, you get the idea that's what they're going for, but
yeah.
There's a lot of weird choices like that.
The music sometimes is really loud, like the way that they've edited it or done the levels. It's like you can barely hear what they're saying, and the music's just crazy over. And it's the same song you've heard.
Yeah.
The theme repeats. Again, there's maybe different iterations of it, but like it's just – they love that song. It's like playing through 20% of the movie, and it's so
like
loud. Yeah.
It's like a character itself in the movie. The song is a character.
I'm sure we can all...
Can a song be a character?
Have you guys... Yes. Like, during our conversation today, it's been 45 minutes, and the song has been playing in my head. Like, I just keep hearing...
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm holding it inside, because I know I'll do a bad version if I try to hum it or something, but I just can't help but hear that song. So, there's something about it.
We'll play it all through through this episode.
Your listeners, if they listen to one of the Doki Doki radios, they might have heard the song. You did play it, David.
That's true. I think episode 101, right?
Here. So, yeah, if they dive into some of your past episodes,
you might be recognizing it. That's true.
That's right.
Yeah.
But yes, the theme is an earworm, and you will be thinking about it, you know, through the next few days.
The first time you hear it, you would never imagine. It does not seem like the kind of thing that would be memorable.
No.
But if you play anything,
it's like two chords.
It'll get stuck in there, I think.
And then, that's where we see Melody's demise playing that melody, you know? So it's kind of haunting in itself. So
that's Sorry.
Yeah, it's good.
So, Matt, you said this is one of your favorite movies of all time. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. I think actually that director that you were talking about, I think he articulated it really well. There's kind of nothing like it.
Mm-hmm.
And once you see it, you can't unsee it, you know, but in a great way, where when you go back on future viewings, I mean, it just seems to get better. And I don't know, that chaotic charm that that goes throughout the movie, and the fact that they spent all this time doing those digital effects and stuff that just look really done well, but they look bad. I mean, they're bad effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's something to that that's kind of amazing.
Would you say it kind of falls into the category of like one of the good, bad movies, like The Room, you know?
I mean, I think you have to kind of watch it in an ironic way, and appreciate it that way.
It has more merit than The Room, for sure.
Yeah.
I would say it's good, bad. Like,
yeah.
My wife hates, I don't know if she hates, hates is strong. She doesn't like the movie. Because I don't think she's as into those good, bad, like, she's more sincere about movie watching.
Yeah, so some people don't like the irony.
Yeah,
going into movies with irony.
Yeah, and when I try to like put any substance to the movie, basically like anything we've said in the second half of this podcast, I don't think she would buy into it. so yeah, I think it's so bad that it's good, kind of thing.
Yes,
but I believe that movies that are so bad that they're good, to really be cult classics, like there has to be more than just being bad. Like there has to be some merit there, and I do think this movie has a lot of merit, actually.
You know what this movie reeks of is being made in a vacuum. Like some movies, like The Room was made in a vacuum, right? Like I feel like this one was probably made in a vacuum,
it's
where he was sitting with his daughter. He was with his daughter, and then he had this like program to do all the video effects, you know, available, and he was just like, "Yeah, this is what I got to do. Let's get in the editing room." And
well, I think too, it's not made to be bad, you know. I think that that's one of the things where like The Room or this movie, it's made, they want it to be good, you know, but maybe through like the editing or special effects or things that are a little bit cheesy, which is where it comes off as, you know, for us watching it a little bit, it's not that well made of a movie. So it was made in earnest, you know, and I think that's kind of separates it from those types of movies where people make movies to be bad and become a cult classic. You know, I can think of like, what are some of those movies? I don't know. I can't think of it now. Like the Sharks that like...
Oh, Sharknado.
Sharknado, yes. Those types of movies where people just make them, I think, to become a cult classic and be bad. But this movie is not that. It's just, it's good, but bad at the same time.
I think it reeks of a time where like a lot of money is probably just being thrown. And I think this movie was pretty much greenlit before. They just really wanted a Jaws to be made. Like... By Jaws, I think Jaws is like big with like teens and younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
Not kids, but like, teen audience or college kids. And they thought this was going to be that. And again, I don't think it was Jaws, but it did pull in actually a decent amount of money, which I was surprised to hear. I thought for sure it would have been a flop.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of his other films? I'm curious if they're anything like this.
There's a short film included on the Blu-ray. I have the Criterion version.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of it, but it's on there. I haven't watched it yet, but no, I'm not at all. I'm quite curious, actually.
Yeah, for another podcast, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we might, the next episode of this might be it might be his next movie.
Do you guys have any final words before I read a little from the Criterion?
I just think if you haven't watched this movie and you listen to this podcast and you've gotten this far, just go. Do yourself a favor and watch it. It's so good.
At least watch to the point where you meet the watermelon man, the guy selling watermelons, because he's actually my favorite character.
I think the trailer does the movie justice. Like, the trailer is what sold me. It's one of those movies where I saw the trailer and I was like, oh man, I think I watched the trailer like 10 times. I was like, I gotta see that movie.
Yes.
You can find it pretty easily online for free if you don't want to buy it, but it is on Criterion as well. Mm-hmm. Which should tell you that we're not crazy for loving it, that Criterion likes it too.
Yeah, the last thing I say is I wonder how influenced he was with the, like, the Dadaist movement that kind of hit Japan, you know, because it is so absurdist that, like, I wouldn't be surprised if he was really into, like, those weird, weird anti-culture movies, you know, and stuff, and poetry and stuff.
If you just look at kind of how he dressed and stuff, he's, like, a pretty, like, psych, you know, got the bell bottoms and kind of, he looked like a pretty artsy dude, so I wouldn't be surprised. All right, so I'll do a little reading here. This is included in the Criterion version. It's by a guy named Chuck Stevens, and he says, Disney had its seven dwarfs. Kurosawa had his seven samurai. For Obayashi, with the help of his 11-year-old daughter, Chigumi, who provided many of the social ideas, it was seven teenage damsels in distress. Kari raised the seventh power, Suspiria spiraling upward into psychedelic seventh heaven. House is a film that must be seen to be believed, and then seen again to be believed that you really did see what you think you saw. A haunted and apparently hungry piano devours a girl named Melody, first finger by finger, then chunk after jagged chunk of her naked teenage torso. Yes, that's true.
Actually teenage.
Yeah. This movie redefines a piece of power when it begins spewing more blood in a tiny format room than The Shining's elevator does in the entire Overlook Hotel. A chubby chick, nicknamed Mac, short for stomach, seduces a watermelon away from a watermelon-shaped watermelon vendor, who's actually the composer of the film's soundtrack, mind blown, and the voice behind the lower-than-lurch enunciation of the film's title spoken aloud, Haosu. And before you can begin to say Sigmund Freud, the girl's favorite hunky school teacher is transformed into a man-sized bunch of bananas. And that's just for starters. In Obayashi's house, there are many, many more rooms to discover. It's like a long essay, but I like that paragraph. So
that's well written.
Yeah, that was really cool.
So anyway, go watch The House if you haven't seen it already. If you've seen it before, go watch it again. Hopefully we taught you something new to look at it, to give it another viewing. But yeah, this is the first of many kind of media reviews. We might do album reviews, definitely a lot more movies. And we've done games before, so we'll do some games. So we'll do about one of these a month.
Well, for me, like, this is the first time I've had a chance to sit down and really enjoy movies in a while, because, you know, I spend my time with music or reading or other things, you know, and I haven't really been watching movies. So, I'm really excited to get into some of the other movies and rewatching some of our favorites, you know, that we've talked about before off mic. A couple that we haven't seen.
That's right. We should watch some new ones and experience them together. It'd be fun. So if you guys have any suggestions of movies that you'd like to hear us kind of review or talk about, we'd probably be open to that. So let us know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll try to do every Dragon Ball, live action Dragon Ball movie.
That's right.
For you. The Taiwanese, the Magic Begins, and then the USA Dragon Ball Evolution.
Big demand for those out there.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Who's closing us out?
you can do it. You do it best. This is your.
All right. Yeah, thanks for listening to Japan 2.0. You can find us all over the internet at Japan 2.0, spell out point. We're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all over the place. Yeah, just come find us and give us a shout. Tell us which movies you want us to review next or which media you'd like us to review. There's some video games. You know, I'm itching to pull out my PS3.
That's right.
Playing a couple of games, you know. Does that sound a little weird? No. Is that why you're laughing?
No.
It did sound a little weird, I bet. But that's all right, because that's Japan 2.0 way, and we like weird things like house.
That's right. The music, like we said, is definitely coming from house today, so check out that soundtrack. Two really cool people I know got it for me on vinyl, so that's out there for you to hunt for as well.
It just got re-released.
On the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just after.
You got one of the originals.
I got the OG. So, yeah.
That's the one with the value. So.
That's right. First pressing, baby. For the high quality house music. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. And look forward to hearing back from you guys and hearing what you guys think we should review next.
Yeah. Till next time.
See ya.